Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. And today we are talking about everything you need to know about transporting industrial hemp. And we are joined by Hoban Law Group senior attorney, David Bush. David, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with this, David. Tell us, how have you been holding up in the last couple of weeks? How have you been personally impacted maybe by COVID-19?
I have to cook a whole lot more. I will say that. We've gotten into a routine where, because I'm home all day working, my wife is working out of the home. She's a veterinarian and has to go into her clinic every day. So I'm the one who's making dinner. When she walks in the door, I hand her a fork and there we go. So that's been a bit different. No more going out to restaurants, very little takeout. We are very much an insular unit these days, like everyone else.
Yeah, very much so. Very reminiscent of what it's like in my household, too, right now. Now David, there's so much to talk about with respect to transportation and hemp. And, you're sitting here. You have the hundreds of pages of the interim final rule issued by USDA on October 31st, 2019, in front of us. And tell us, how many pages are devoted to the issue of transportation?
Well, far less than one. It's perhaps about an inch and a half double-spaced in this notebook that I have that's probably a good 3 inches thick, containing the interim final rule in all of its glory.
Well, and that's a big issue, because a lot of states and a lot of operators were looking to this federal guidance for how they are going to conduct their business, how they are going to transport, whether it's raw material, processed material, throughout the country. So what does this mean? What does this lack of insight in the IFR to transportation mean for the industry?
Well, what it means is that we have two paths forward, and one of them I think is a bit doubtful, and the other is one that nobody seems to want to talk about, but I think is the way that we probably are going to have to go. The way that's probably doubtful is to expect that the federal government is going to play any major role in supporting hemp transportation. It has spoken its piece. It's minimal to the point of almost not being there, and so there have been some people who have voiced a desire to see some federal rules come out, some changes in the law that will more aggressively and affirmatively support hemp and transportation. And at least from what I've seen, the political will is not there. Maybe that'll change, but I haven't seen any indication that's really going to happen. What we have is a lot of states that are more than willing to experiment. They have been for years in this space. And I think that there's a great opportunity for there to be cooperation among the states. What the federal government can't do, the states could. They need the will. They need the willingness to cooperate. And we can talk a bit more about that. But I think that that may be the direction we need to go in by default.
I'd like to talk about how the states can cooperate, David. But the first thing I wanted to talk about is, when you look at states, look at the converse of that. Instead of cooperating, what about states that aren't cooperating? Idaho comes to mind, a state that has not implemented hemp legislation or hemp regulations. There's been a couple high-profile seizures of hemp-derived products and hemp biomass in the state of Idaho. And the feds have effectively said, well, look, this is legal under federal law, and that you should not, to your point, interfere with transportation. But that is devoted, that principle is in three sentences maximum. There's not elaboration on that. So how do you look at that from a state standpoint? Does this create a scenario where, all right, the state of Idaho can't interfere with the federal transport of federally legal product, industrial hemp biomass coming through the state, but you can't possess it within the state? Doesn't that reek of some sort of equal protection or due process type issue?
Well, I think that what it could implicate is the Commerce Clause. And a corollary of the Commerce Clause, and I'm referring to what's in our U.S. Constitution. There's a section of the Constitution that talks about the power and authority of the federal government to regulate interstate commerce. There's a corollary to that that cases, courts talk about, which is the inverse Commerce Clause. And that is, well, if the federal government has the authority and power to regulate interstate commerce, that means states can't. And that means, to extend it further, that states shouldn't unduly interfere with interstate commerce. Though what we want is a national market. That is the whole purpose of having a United States, a constitution, is that in the very early years of our republic, we had states that were imposing import duties on other states. They were issuing their own currency. They were doing all kinds of crazy things that were endangering our ability to have a national economy. So you're right that there is a fundamental tension in the law as it has been written for hemp regulation, in that the Congress has given the federal government authority to regulate hemp, but then it has deferred mightily to the states and even given states the ability to more severely restrict hemp regulation in their states or even prohibit hemp production and sales. Well, is that a burden on interstate commerce? I think there's a good argument that it can be. It has been tested. We are going to have to see how that plays out over the years. We're going to have to see if there really are states that are so opposed to hemp that it becomes a problem.
You know, incidentally, David, you talk about states printing their own currency. You know, this building that we're in here in Denver, the Equitable Building, built by a pair of brothers, finalized in 1892 from the Equitable Insurance Company. They were renegades. They were frontiersmen. They did, in fact, print their own money, Colorado money, in this building in the basement many, many, many years ago. So that's an interesting
thing.
But think about, talk a little bit more about how states can collaborate as it relates to transportation.
Well, an idea that I have talked up with a lot of people, and you know, we've yet to see any official action on this. Right now, I'm just trying to convince people it might be a good idea, is the idea of an interstate compact. And when you start looking at Colorado law, and we are very, very consistent with other states in this regard, we have dozens and dozens of laws in our books that are based on interstate compacts. Let me give you an example. And I'll start with this kind of hypothetical story. Let's say you got a Colorado driver's license, like most people around you do, and you drive into the state of Missouri. And you get stopped by the state police because you have, I don't know, a taillight out. Well, what's every police officer going to do when they stop someone on the highway? They come up and they ask, "May I see your license and registration?" I can guarantee that'll happen. I'll guarantee you something that won't happen. That Missouri police officer is not going to look at your Colorado license and say, "Oh, you have a Colorado driver's license? You realize now you're in the state of Missouri. You're going to have to take a driving test if you want to drive on our roads." Doesn't happen. Why? There is an interstate compact. There is essentially a treaty among states on driver's licenses. And one thing it says in that treaty, so to speak, is we will recognize and accept the driver's licenses of any other signatory to this compact. And every state in the union is a member of this driver's license compact. There are other compacts on wildlife and sharing of information on violators of hunting licenses. There's compacts on child support. They go on and on and on. My thought that I've shared with people is, since we can't count on the federal government to regulate hemp transportation and protect interstate commerce, maybe what we need is an interstate compact on hemp transportation. And it would provide some standards on shipping documentation. It would provide some protocols that states would follow when they're stopping and inspecting shipments. There'd be some common expectations we could have with the interstate compact that if you have the proper documentation, if you follow the proper procedures, you should be able to leave the state of Colorado, cross Kansas, cross Missouri, as many states as you want, and they will treat you the same, and they will, this is another buzzword, full faith and credit, that they will accord full faith and credit to your documents that show that you brought legal hemp in from Colorado. They're not going to say, we have to test it again. We're going to have to do all these things because we think it might be marijuana. No, not if you have the approved documentation and follow other protocols and procedures. That's the idea of an interstate compact. And I'm hoping that that idea could catch on, because I think it's probably one of the better solutions that we have available.
Well, that's a great example, the driver's license example, just as a way to think about this. And I think to bring it back to the IFR, you know, there were a number of people who were looking to this document to provide clarity on this. And now, to your point, in the lack of federal guidance, now it is incumbent upon the states to try to figure this out. And here in Colorado, there was the establishment of the Colorado Hemp Advancement and Management Plan, CHAMP, as it is called, where they gathered stakeholders in the industry and tried to address certain topics, whether it's processing, genetics, and transportation was one of these subject matters. Will you tell us a little bit about the work of CHAMP and maybe the work you're doing with CHAMP to try to get this issue sorted out here in Colorado?
Sure. Yes, the CHAMP initiative, it involved 8 different stakeholder groups. They all met at various times last fall. I was invited to be on the transportation stakeholders group. And representatives were there from the governor's office, from the Colorado State Patrol, from the Colorado Department of Public Health and the Environment, the Department of Agriculture, and lots of different people from industry, farmers, processors, testing laboratories, transporting companies, people who are trying to start up new businesses in hemp transportation. There were even a group of, I'll say kids, because they were young men, and everyone looks like a kid to me now, but there were 3 young men from Wyoming that had come down just to observe. Why? Because they were developing a blockchain system, a technology for tracking hemp and centralizing the collection of data, which would be the precursor for some kind of a system that perhaps many states could use, perhaps through an interstate compact. Think of that. A data system, a tracking system. So if someone had some doubt about what you were transporting, there's actually a number they could call. There's a website they could get on. There's a person they could talk to who would vouch for your validity, your legitimacy. So we talked about things like that in this transportation stakeholders group. Here's the overall impression I had, is there was really very little disagreement. And I've certainly been involved in other stakeholder groups where people at each other's throats, they had such disagreements. That was not present on the stakeholders group. It was very diverse. And yet when we talked, we were all talking the same language. We broadly agreed on just about every issue that came up. The idea with, more broadly speaking, with the CHAMP stakeholders groups is they are to provide citizen and regulatory and law enforcement input into what the future of hemp is going to look like in Colorado. It is really the basis of policy making in the state. That was the intent. My involvement right now is I'm working with the Department of Agriculture on putting together kind of a first product from our effort, and that would be a guidance document on shipping documentation, primarily. Also best practices, but that would require input from a number of people, not just from one dumb lawyer. So I think my real contribution might be on some recommendations for shipping documentation. That guidance document will be published as a collaborative effort of the Department of Agriculture, Public Health and the Environment, the Colorado State Patrol, Colorado Association of Motor Carriers, and so on and so forth. What I personally hope is that this could be the beginning of some regulatory changes in the state. And that is where everybody seems to be a little bit wary for different reasons. There's different opinions on why we should or shouldn't move forward. But at some point, there has to be some government authority to back up this whole initiative. And it's, again, it's not really coming from the federal government. I think it needs to come from the states.
Sure. Well, and you know, maybe another important point to address here, and you have a great analogy for this, But hemp is a commodity that needs to be transported. It simply it fits into supply chains that are national, if not international, in scope. And so maybe you can tell us about this analogy for why hemp versus marijuana. There is just this greater need for clarity at any level, federal level, state level, for transportation guidance.
Well, one thing that I do a lot as an attorney is I think and I talk in terms of analogies, trying to take a more complex topic and boil it down to something that's more everyday to people, that uses images and situations that are very familiar to people. And then I can say, well, then what we're talking about is like that. And suddenly light bulbs go on. And so what I like to talk to people about is, what makes hemp different from marijuana? Okay, and everyone wants to talk about THC. And I would say, oh, that's nothing. That's just a chemical. It's a concentration. It's arbitrary. That can change on a daily basis. It doesn't really fill me with any kind of real sense of understanding. Here's the analogy I like to use for what makes hemp different from marijuana. It's islands versus empires. And this is how it works. Marijuana is more or less a consumer end product. It's very high valued, and supply chains are relatively short. That combined with the fact that marijuana is state legal and federally illegal makes it necessary to run the whole business concept of marijuana on an island model, which is you're on an island. It's called a state. Call it Montana. Call it Colorado. I don't care. Your product, marijuana, is going to be legal as long as it stays on that island. It's going to be born. It's going to grow up. It's going to be processed. It's going to be manufactured. It's going to be processed and packaged. It's going to go on retail store shelves, all the stuff inside that island. And God forbid it ever leaves, because then you're committing a federal crime. So marijuana has kind of developed its whole economy, its whole business nature around the idea that we have short supply chains, high-valued products that don't go very far. They have to be profitable where they're born. Now, can you imagine that working for cornflakes? Can you imagine an industry where to make cornflakes, you got to grow the corn, you got to process it, package it, sell it, all within the state of Iowa? You know, so we wouldn't have cornflakes. It wouldn't survive. It's a much lower-valued product, smaller margins. It needs large economies of scale. Okay, corn moves around the world. Corn moves in an empire. Same thing with hemp. Most hemp products, and apart from, say, your high-valued consumer CBD products, that's a bit of an exception, but we're talking about seed, fiber, all the other applications for hemp. They have to really have large markets, large audiences. They have to be mobile. And so what I tell people in the hemp industry, especially when they're looking at getting into it, is you got to think globally. It's not that you have to be the next multinational corporation, but you've got to understand that you can't really just look at the county you're in as your world. A hemp business or a marijuana business might be able to do that very well. A hemp business can't. A hemp grows in an empire. What does that mean? We've got huge transportation needs. Why do you think we're sitting here talking about hemp transportation? It's because we've got an empire that we have to navigate around, and we still have legal barriers to that. We have technical barriers. We have all kinds of challenges that we have got to sort out to make hemp work economically.
Well, maybe this is a good point just to switch gears and touch a little bit on how we are going to get hemp to really be that global commodity, how it really is going to fit into those supply chains. And I think that a part of that is working with research institutions to get federal grant money and do the research, do the development, really experiment to just show how many applications there are of hemp. You, of course, have a role to play in that with the Industrial Hemp Research Foundation. Maybe you can give us a quick update and, what is the IHRF and what's going on with it right now?
Sure. I guess I have to go back into ancient history. And ancient history in this space is somewhere around 5 years or 6 years. And 6 years ago, I was I started getting interested in hemp and what it was and what hemp law involved and what the opportunities were. And so I started going to a few expos and meeting people. And one thing I wanted to know, because one thing I realized when I was talking to people is nobody knew anything. The amount of ignorance, the amount of reliance that people had on kind of colloquial stories and belief sets that they had, it was astounding. And I started asking people, well, who's doing research? Who actually are the scientists out there who are trying to find credible, objective answers to questions about this plant and its applications and its limitations? And I quickly found out, talking to several people, there were about two people in Colorado that anybody could think of. Both of them were university professors, and both had about zero support from their employers. They had formed their own companies and were trying to do research as much as they could on their own outside of their universities. It became apparent to me there was no money. There was no federal money, and there was really no state money. There was no material support for research, and we badly needed that because nobody knew anything. And thus, that was the genesis of the Industrial Hemp Research Foundation. So I founded that in January 2015. The purpose of the organization was to raise funds to support hemp-related education and academic research projects at institutions of higher education. And that's what we exist today for. We have partnerships with about six university campuses in the state of Colorado. We have partnerships with two universities outside of the state of Colorado. We're currently working on a third outside the state. And we are trying to network with people who want to do research and are looking for the resources to support their efforts. And it's tough. It's tough finding that money, but I'm telling you, sometimes it's better than nobody getting anything. So we are trying to fill that gap. What we see today is government money is starting to flow, which is a very good thing. And it doesn't necessarily mean the end to our foundation. What it could mean is that we will change our role a bit. We might be more of a supplemental funding organization. We might fill gaps where people, for whatever reason, are unable to get support. Maybe it's not popular enough. It's not interesting enough to the right people to get the money from government grants. But maybe we can still find a partnership with some company that wants to see that happen. And that's what we try to do as a foundation.
Well, and that's very valuable work, because that is one of the key things that's going to advance this industry, as well as all of these concerns and considerations with transportation. And I think I speak for everybody when I say, after listening to this, after listening to you speak, David, we all know a lot more about hemp transportation than we did when we started. Thank you for coming on and being a guest today of the Hoban Minute, and we can't wait to have you on again.
Well, thank you again. I've really enjoyed being here.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Hoban Minute special series on coronavirus and cannabis. You can head on over to hoban.law for more information on this podcast or the Hoban Law Group. If you have any ideas for subjects that we should be covering or any questions you want to pose to Bob or myself, shoot us an email at media@hoban.law. Stay tuned for the next episode on this special series, Coronavirus and Cannabis.